You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Regine Basha. She's an independent curator based in Brooklyn, New York. Regine, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Brainerd.
Let's talk about Basha Projects and the curatorial output that you're known for. What are you involved in right now, or what's the show that's up now? And then maybe we should talk about past work, but I'd love to talk about what you're involved in right now.
Sure. Okay, well, we can start with right now, and I can go into Basha Projects a little bit as well afterwards. Currently open until July 19th, there is a show that I guest curated for a group called No Longer Empty, and I've worked with No Longer Empty before. They're a great organization, a nonprofit. They've been around 5 years, and they take on abandoned spaces or empty storefronts. They started off in the year 2008, I think, when the crash happened and there was a lot of empty space around New York. But it's grown into a little bit more than just empty spaces. So a lot of it is kind of site-specific or context-specific commissions by artists. So sometime last fall, they approached me and told me they were invited to do a project in an old courthouse in the Bronx, that in the South Bronx, that had been sealed for 40 years, was just boarded up. And it happens to be this gorgeous 19th century neoclassical monument. It's actually a landmark building.
Wow.
The inside is gutted. It had been stripped. It was looted. It was, you know, operating in the 70s, so it was operating when the Bronx was, you know, vacant lots burning and all of that. And they closed it up because it became too small for all the cases, and they opened up another courthouse in the meantime. So it just got boarded up, and it got sold on auction really cheap in the 90s. And just, you know, nothing happened. Anyway, entering this building was phenomenal. And I'm really honored to have been chosen to curate this show there. The show is called When You Cut Into the Present, the Future Leaks Out, which is a quote by William S. Burroughs. And it's very much, you know, I mean, it says what it is, basically. It's about an approach to this building that when you enter it, you realize has many, many layers of history visible. And it made me also think of Gordon Mata Clark, who, you know, is one of the specters, I think, of this project. Physical slicing through the building that's happening. It's being not renovated because it's not going to be anything other than what it is, but it's definitely being worked on. And as we were producing the exhibition, construction team was alongside us, you know, cleaning and making sure that it could be entered safely and have permit for assembly. So it is, I wouldn't say construction site, but it's definitely raw, and it's been thrilling working in this space. I think for all the artists as well, there's 27 artists in the show. Yeah. I can go into
Wow.
more if you'd like.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So that is an undertaking. Sounds just fantastic. So yeah, tell us a little bit more. I want to go into other projects, but about the artists in the show, how the artists were put together. You don't have to go into each individual, but how that group was put together.
Yeah, I mean, to give you an idea, because we had so little time, I think by January 23rd, I finally got to really see the space. And by the way, there was no heat, so, you know, we installed all the way through this intense winter we had. So my thought was initially, many thoughts came to mind in terms of the building being so charged and, you know, characteristic. It almost felt like barely anything should happen there, and really you should just tour the building with maybe occasional subtle triggers by artists that would almost be invisible. I was thinking of a sound show, for instance. But, you know, it, it grew, and, you know, it grew on me in different ways. And I decided that, well, with the time constraints and with the conditions, I would mostly have to work with artists that I have a real understanding with, that I've worked with before, that I know have a practice already based in either revisionist history or context-specific installation or interventionist strategies, these kinds of, you know, these kinds of working, let's say, processes that are very much in line with entering an abandoned building.
Right. Related to the whole space, yeah.
Exactly. So that it wouldn't be them starting from scratch. But in some cases, that didn't actually happen. I mean, I can say, for instance, with the artist, really great installation in the basement of the building, David Scannavino. He's someone I did not know and saw work of his at the Aldridge Museum a year back, and he does this kind of floor tile installation with linoleum tiles from, you know, institutions. So it's very, very reminiscent of that kind of bureaucratic, you know, old public school floor, for instance.
Right.
And he, not knowing him, I went to the gallery and asked them what they thought, and, you know, they were like, well, yeah, you know, maybe you can borrow a piece. And I convinced them to bring David to the building and just see it for himself, and then he can decide if he wanted to actually make something for the building or we borrow a piece. And that was one of the first moments where I got to see an artist enter with me, and he just got so excited. I mean, we didn't have to say anything. It was at the end. It was like, I'm doing something here. And I mean, luckily we did have a decent commissioning budget, so that was great. So in some cases there are, you know, sculptural, physical installations that deal with the history of the building. It being a courthouse, you know, of course that's, you know, very of the moment, really. So there's quite a lot of nuances that have to do with civil rights and social justice. But at the same time, the physicality of the building itself is an abstraction. So in terms of bringing out almost like a sensorial experience, I was really interested in marrying that with the narrative and having these moments where the works would sometimes be really visible and sometimes hold back and allow you to really get a sense of the building as well, sort of in a more...
Right. I was thinking in one sense, it's competing with such a powerful architecture that that's a delicate kind of dance to make.
I mean,
Because I remember the shows that, I don't know if you saw those shows that Creative Time produced, that the Anchorage, I think, in the late 90s. And
absolutely,
this space always competed with the work. And sometimes it was successful and sometimes it wasn't. But, the space was crazy.
Like that. Yeah, it's exactly like that kind of situation.
Right.
And a lot of the art, you know, I mean, so it's...
That's very challenging.
There were two prongs to this. So, you know, there was a group of artists that I had worked with before, Daniel Boshkoff, Paul Ramirez Jonas, you know, I mean, there's a group here, Ellen Harvey, Beth Campbell, Julianne Swartz, and then there's a group who I've always wanted to work with, Lisa Siegel, Adam Helms, Iman Issa, Nicolas Demit Estevez, Abigail DeVille, Onya de Kachuke. Then there's a group who I did very kind of, you know, rough and tumble quick studio visits with throughout the Bronx. I must have done, two days of studio visits in residency programs and by recommendation, and met about, might say, 8 or 10 artists who are from within the Bronx who know the building and grown up around it. So that was exciting too, and I decided to invite more of the younger and up-and-coming artists from that area. And, you know, really interesting because, you know, the Bronx is really, it's like a, I mean, the pride of place is huge there, and people have been there for generations. You know, they're not the New Yorkers that are coming in and out from Europe or, you know, wherever. I mean, it's very much like a, like its own country in a way. So I became very interested and wanted very much to have their voice there too. And just the mingling of that was really interesting. You know, the artists who are coming in because of their practice being that way, and then the artists who are not coming in because of their practice, but coming in because they know that building and the narrative around it and the context so well.
Yeah, that's very interesting and sounds so exciting, and in a way sounds like a, as you talk about it, because the building is, you know, so exceptional, it's sort of a paradigm for a curator, isn't it? You have a building that has interesting enough architecture that it somehow has a life of its own, but
yeah,
also that is a place that a curator is managing artists having a dialogue with to some extent, right? Because it's...
Yeah, to some extent, it became clear that, you know, it'd be really important to visit the building often to get to know it. We had 3 floors given to us while the upper floors were still being, are still being worked on. So even, I mean, even entering it the first time, you can't get your head around what's going on exactly, you know, what, where that room was again, or, you know, it has this building has this sort of element to it that has a lot of mirrored effects. So there are rooms that look like other rooms, and they're on the opposite sides of each other. They're mirrored. Beth Campbell actually did a project about a mirrored room in there. Really, really great. So there's a lot of uncanny moments where you think you've been there before, that room before, but you're not sure. And then there's rooms upon rooms. You keep going in, and then there's like a little room attached to another room, and you're, and some of these rooms were in fact holding cells, or, you know, small prisons, but they
right.
don't look like them anymore. So we're not, we were never given a map, or no one had one, a floor plan of what was what. So a lot is left up to your imagination, and you know,
well, it's
that,
loaded.
That's,
it's like an insane asylum.
It's
really loaded.
It is.
What happened there? You know?
Yeah. It's very loaded. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do early on was bring like a kind of, you know, ritualistic performance, like a Santeria voodoo master to cleanse the building. And I had been thinking about that almost half jokingly, but then getting closer to the show, I was really thinking about it. And then completely out of the blue, one of the artists does this, Nicolas David Estevez. He has a video in the show. But he just emailed me out of the blue and said, you know, I was thinking, like, I can do this, but I want to make it like a kind of, you know, performance that's stealthy. Like, I'll just walk in and do it. No announcement, no set time, nothing. You know, I have this way of doing it. So he's been doing that throughout the whole show. And it's interesting. The show definitely has transformed the building, and the building continues to transform the show. Every time I go in there, or anybody else who's spending time there, we all say the same thing. It looks different. It looks different every time. It's like this, because it almost feels like a public space. It's kind of almost outside, so it's like it's got its own weather, weather pattern. I don't know. The air is different. The smell is different. The light, everything looks a little bit different. The way people engage with it, that we've had an enormous, really wonderful response from the neighborhood and people from around the Bronx, but mostly from the immediate neighborhood, people coming in with their kids, with their dogs, and they come out with this sort of amazement on their face, like, I can't believe this is in my neighborhood, you know? it's really wonderful.
And what kind of work are they seeing? I mean, that is really wonderful, you know, Rasheen. I mean, I love the idea of, you know, a neighborhood coming in, a crowd that's not necessarily a typical art-going crowd, you know, interacting with work and these artists. What kind of work are they seeing? And is there work in there that you think is having a particular impact? And now I am saying maybe talk about a specific artist if you want, and how, you know, the local community is experiencing that, because I think that's unusual and special. It's not your typical alternative space getting the, you know, the hip crowd that always goes there.
Well, exactly. You know, it feels so good to not be preaching to the converted all the time, and, you know, and see how, what an impact art still has. You know, it's just, it's great.
And so, yeah, so I guess maybe I should ask you, is there an artist there that you think did have a lot of impact with the local?
Oh, yeah.
For
sure,
and
more than one.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe people talk often when they come out, especially the younger crowd, they'll often, you know, because we always ask them, what was your favorite?
Right, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. No, there's at least 5 I could think of that really seem to translate well, let's say. But there's one in particular that is by Teresa Dill, who is a Lebanese artist from Miami who has worked with No Longer Empty before, and she creates these incredible labyrinths, that you, these structures you walk through. And as you walk through them, there's projection onto them as well. And they're made from very, very fine filaments that she then kind of coats with the, almost feels like beeswax or something. It's a very labor-intensive piece to build. It took weeks. And so she attaches sensors to them, and you can strum the filaments like an instrument. So it's as if you're walking through this almost harp-like instrument that is a maze, with projections onto it as well. And then there's another room that has a similar structure but in black. And a lot of it is kind of news imagery. It sort of has to do with media saturation and being trapped within media saturation. But because you can play it as well, it then takes on this other role as an instrument and with your body. And I think people respond to that incredibly. Like, what is that? You know, and play it. And I think the musicality of it really, you know, really appeals to people that have been coming in just without knowing, you know, if it's art or not.
Right.
That conversation never even comes up. It's just transgressive. It really takes care of that space. It's immersive. And there's another immersive installation downstairs by Abigail DeVille, who is born and raised in the Bronx, and has now received really international attention. In fact, she's on Art 21, and she's a really, I call her like the Ed Keenholz of our time, you know. It's really incredible. Mm. I mean, and how her work actually does relate to the Beat Generation in this really interesting way. So her installation is very much about the Bronx at the time in the 70s when the building was operating, and this highly immersive kind of junk sculpture with trees and soil and lights and sound objects, TVs, radios, all low-tech, you know, kind of from another era. It's almost haunting. It's a bit scary. People have been commenting. It's, you know, it's dark, actually. You have to walk into a dark room to see it, and then there's just lights that come up. And, that's been a conversation piece, let's say. We really have great conversations around it. And then right next to that, you know, there's like two or three other installations that that's all in the basement of the building that are also, I call it sensorial because they really, you know, they deliver their information straight to your senses. So you're not having to read a text to understand, you know, well, what's this about? There's a room right next to Abigail's, which is very spare and probably one of the most beautiful architectural remains of the building. And we're calling it the sound room because it's a sound piece, but many people have said they really like that piece. And it's Daniel Newman collaborating with a sculptor, Juan Betancourt from Colombia. Daniel's a sound engineer. Created this, they just worked the room and, you know, brought these sound speakers that were sculptural. They turned the speakers into sculptures that were, you know, kind of abstractions. And then they took sound elements from the building, inhabited the building for a while and actually recorded it and banged on it and used the building as an instrument and created a composition. So as you go in, you're drawn to these different smaller and larger speakers and points, and it's really well done. We gave access to many of the artists about 2 months and just let them know they could spend time there, you know, produce work there, make a film. There's an artist, Kakao, who directed a film in the building at night, and it's incredible. It's like a surrealist, you know, film. Very strange, and it's about Lady Justice and questioning all the symbols that are on the building about justice, and why is she always a lady, and why is she blindfolded, why is she always white? He asks all these questions like through this symbolic imagery in the film.
Sounds wonderful. You know, it's such an alive show. You know, you were talking about all these these kind of sensorial, as you were saying, or immersive exhibits, mm-hmm. and it made me think that, you know, as you were saying, these were the ones that people were, some of the people were talking about the most that are emerging, that are from a local neighborhood or I suppose many other places. Mm-hmm. But that's exciting. It sounds to me also like, you know, where are we now in art and how the public mm-hmm. is viewing it? In a way, that seemed like a paradigm.
Well, okay.
That you said where people don't necessarily know mm-hmm. if it's art or not. But they just, right. they get involved. They're not judging it. Is this good or is this bad? Was that a good painting or a bad painting? They're somehow immersed. Is that a paradigm that's also you're reaching for? Because it seems to be one that beyond, I don't know what relational aesthetics means now, but that it's somehow a new form of performance or interactivity, isn't it?
It's true. Yeah. Well, for sure. And there's a lot to say about this. I mean, I've always been wary of art bordering on entertainment and you know, wary of museum programs that sometimes are, you know, bring the Karsten Haller slide, you know, so that it's fun. And, you know, sometimes
right.
I get a little, you know, kind of just cynical about it and think, okay, there should be more of a discussion about this or whatever. And yeah, I hear you. I think right now we're dealing with the competition vis-a-vis, you know, just popular culture in general and just everything. It's like we have to up the ante for an experience now because, you know, if it doesn't do something to you, then, you know, you can easily just walk by it in a second. So it's hard for art right now. It's hard for museums. It's hard. I mean, you know, we're in a hyper mediated and visual time, which is why I like sound. But said, I think I'm cognizant of the fact that this could look like a fun house, you know, so I went over the top. I tried to really mingle, and you know, I spoke about those pieces which were attractive, let's say, to a local audience and others as well. I mean, people who are coming to see, you know, what they already know and the artists that they already are familiar with, and all kinds of things to say. But I feel like mingling that with some of the more royal work that was really speaking to the experience of, you know, I would say an African-American history within that building, Xavier Simmons' work is like, you know, and Onyedika Chuke very much does that. And then there's film and video about senior citizens living in the area and what their experience of the Bronx is like. And it's this documentary, but it's very, it's like in small vignettes that show their real flamboyant character. that portrays them. And it's so there's moments where the works are not exact, because the building is so big, I should say, it was almost so joyful for me to be able to almost have like three shows in one, you know?
Right.
Each floor has its own feeling to it. So the viewer has a chance to go through, think it's one way, and then they'll go through it and there's another way to see it. And then the works that they're seeing on the top floor will inform the way that they'll rethink the bottom floor, you know, rethink Abigail Deville's installation. Of course, like any kind of curatorial process, you want the cross connections to happen so that the works reveal many layers. And it's not just entertainment at the end of the day. And I think that happens. I've been finding it happening really, you know, sometimes you plan it, but then you can't really plan it to the 10th degree. So you plan it and then you let it go. And then there's some kind of organic process that tends to happen when you're just in the mode of installing. And then you don't realize it until maybe the fifth time you've walked through it that, oh, there is this connection between, you know, Lisa Siegel and, you know, Xavier Simmons, which I didn't think of before, and that's lovely because it just means that your mind is sort of chewing on it for so long that you don't even notice anymore.
Regine, thanks so much for talking with us today. Is there anything else the audience needs to know to come to the show that's up now that we've been talking about?
Sure. First of all, I'd suggest go to the website, nolongerempty.org, and check the program for performance schedules. I know one in particular is Deborah Fisher and Paul Ramirez Jonas open a store in the building occasionally. And I think that is happening this Saturday. The hours are Thursday through Sunday, 1 to 7. And, yeah, check the website for details how to get there and all of that. It's up until July 19th. And for any other information on my shows, dashaprojects.com is my website, and it chronicles the whole history as well as writing and some interviews with various artists as well.
Regine, thanks so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.